Global warming is bringing more severe storms and rising sea levels, and some airports are at risk.
We could have flooding of some of our taxiways or runways. We could have problems with some of our infrastructure.
I'm Kara Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, planning for climate change at the airport. Plus, most cities have also built roads and bridges for last century's weather.
The rules of the game are changing on us as our own fault. And now we have to figure out how are we going to play in this new world that we've created.
And a new book of poetry and photographs looks at the risks and benefits after a decade of fracking in Pennsylvania.
I really want people to ask if it's worth it. Is this worth it?
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. If you want to know if there's a pipeline carrying natural gas near your home or your kids' school, good luck. Maps showing nearly 80,000 miles of natural gas pipelines in Pennsylvania aren't readily available to the public. 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis reports that includes the pipeline that exploded recently in Beaver County.
There are three types of natural gas pipelines: large transmission lines, medium-sized gathering pipelines, and small distribution lines that go to homes and businesses. Only transmission pipeline maps are available to the public by the federal government. Nils Hagen Fredrickson is with the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission, which makes sure companies adhere to state and federal pipeline safety regulations.
There were recommendations made several years ago by the state's Pipeline Infrastructure Task Force, recommendations that the commission supported in terms of the development of a more centralized system in Pennsylvania for public access to mapping. That's still a work in progress.
Hagen Fredrickson says pipeline operators are required to do regular public outreach to make sure property owners close to pipelines are aware of their existence. Aside from more clear maps, activists say they'd like to see more local involvement and consideration in where pipelines are placed. Kathleen Davis in Pittsburgh.
Julia Spiker-Kasdorf is a poet, and Steven Rubin is a photographer. They both teach at Penn State, and several years ago, each started exploring, independently, how the Marcellus shale industry was affecting land and people in Pennsylvania. So how did you come together?
Magic. I mean, I'm joking in saying that, but I think there really was an element of it.
They met through the Penn State Marcellus Shale Gas Ethics Interest Group.
For me, I was feeling a certain sort of deficiency in my own medium and feeling like the photographs needed something more. They needed history. They needed backstory. They needed description. They needed some kind of way to help the viewer understand what the images were about without necessarily explaining them all away.
Wallace Stevens, during World War II, he was talking about poets who were writing politically, and he talked about the pressure of the real and how this pressure can burden the poem. And I was feeling that. In many cases, I'm really trying to work with the language that I hear or the language that I find in documents, the language that I see on signs. And so I was feeling this pressure and hoping for something more immediate or transcendent or sort of charged, which visual images bring to text, I think.
And the result is Shale Play, a book of Rubin's photographs and Kasdorf's documentary poems. Julia, one of the poems in the book that really caught my attention is entitled F Word. Would you read it?
Sure. Let me see if I can find it. And I'll introduce this poem by saying that the word fracking is a slang word that comes out of the industry. And it's a shortened version of the word fracturing. But when activists started making signs and sticking the K in the word, that became the standard spelling. It's here in an epigraph in the poem. F word. Without the K, it looks less violent. Water pressure creates fractures that allow oil and gas to escape, as if they were trapped under tight regulatory control. Blame the fractivists, fracademics. A bumper sticker claims, "I'm surrounded by gas holes." Frack her till she blows, says the T-shirt stretched over a roughneck's belly at the Williamsport Wegmans. Frackville, PA, named for Daniel Frack, Vrack, from Middle Low German, greedy, stingy, damaged, useless. Are you going to say what the word suggests? A student timidly asks. To women, I mean? Frack it, a sophomore explains, is that hoodie worn over a spaghetti strap dress to a frat house, an old jacket that won't matter if it gets stolen or left behind on a flagstone patio, splattered with someone else's vomit.
And then it's paired with a photo of a street sign that reads Frack Lane with no K. It stuck out to me because of the wordplay, but also, it seemingly connects environmental issues with a lot of social issues that we're talking about right now. Was that your intention?
Yes. And it's an old trope, right? The earth is a female body. I mean, that goes back to antiquity. But vomiting and flow back at a gas well is a newer kind of metaphor. And then these words, fractivist, fracademic, I'm surrounded by gas holes. I'm intrigued by the way this industrial activity is changing our language. And then, frack her till she blows, that's actually a thing that you can buy on a T-shirt or on a hat. But that's where the idea of sexual exploitation and this industrial activity is introduced in the poem and then through to the end. And because I'm here with students at Penn State, which has this very public problem right now with fraternities, like a lot of schools like this, it seems that the poem is asking us to think about these things in relation to one another.
Environmental degradation and...
Well, sexual assault, I mean, or sexual assault or excessive, whatever makes you throw up at a frat house, probably excessive drinking, right? But it's mistreatment of the body, of the human body, mistreatment of the earth's body.
Stephen, do you have a favorite image from the book or one that means more to you or is personal to you?
There's an image that I am fond of. It's a photograph that extends over about a page and a half. It's of three workers. You just see them basically from their calves down. You see their boots and you see their work pants. And in the center of the frame, there's sort of up close because the other two workers are flanking this center pair of boots. There's a man that. One of his pants leg is worn, and you can just see where the part of his boot, which is used to sort of pull up the boot, this is sort of sticking out on the one pant leg, and as a result, has maybe over time has worn out the bottom of the pant leg, the cuff there, in effect, and so it's threaded and it's worn, and there's a long thread that kind of falls down, and there's other threads that have kind of just been bunched up. So I think for me that image. Just speaks to some of the idea of hope, of promise, of the idea of a future, of a steady paycheck, of a way out of dead end jobs or minimal jobs or no jobs in parts of rural Pennsylvania. But it also is not perhaps as glowing or as promising as it kind of initially appears. The particular photograph was actually taken at a training center which run by Pennsylvania College of Technology, where they're training students as well as workers or laid off workers to go into this industry. And so the particular man whose boots are up close in the photograph is a man who actually worked for Halliburton here in Pennsylvania for 5 years, and after 5 years was laid off. And so his decision then was to go back to school, to go back for more training, to try to develop more skills, to be able to return to the industry and get another job. There's parts of the backstory that are not certainly not evident in the photograph itself, but it speaks to something that I think is an important part of this story.
We're about a decade into the shale gas industry in Pennsylvania, and you've been gathering, creating these materials for the book for several years. What do you want people to take away from it now, in this moment?
I really want people to ask if it's worth it. Is this worth it?
Worth the...
the expense, the risk, the environmental degradation.
Right. I think it's part of that wanting people to see it, right? Because I think it's very, as widely as this is practiced across kind of key parts of this state, it's very easy to miss it. It's very easy to drive around and have no clue that it's there, or it's hard to notice what's going on. So I think that's part of the purpose of the work, is to get people to see it and to pay attention, to notice it, to think about what's gained, but also what's lost. Our tendency is always to be looking ahead.
Oh, another thing that dawned on me gradually as I was talking with people and thinking about it is how important it is to understand this industry in relation to our history in Pennsylvania. And people who are not transient, people who remain in local communities, have that long memory and can draw connections, for instance, in Fayette County between coal and coke and natural gas. And that knowledge is very important, I think, as we consider the possibilities and the potential, but also, you know, these cycles of boom and bust that come with this kind of extractive industry.
So of just going back to what you said, you'd like people to ask themselves if it's worth it. Is that a question that you've answered yourself?
I guess so. I mean, I didn't enter the project with a clear position in mind at all. But I think the people who bear the burden of this industry are bearing a very great burden. And I'm not sure that's worth it.
Thanks to both of you for talking with me.
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding? Thank you so much for your interest.
Thank you so much.
That was Julia Spiker-Kasdorf, a poet, and Stephen Rubin, a photographer. Their new book from Penn State University Press is called Shale Play. There's more, including a look at some of those photographs, at AlleghenyFront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. President Trump seems to be frustrated by many environmental regulations.
I've seen a highway recently in a certain state. I won't mention its name. It's 17 years. I could have built it for $4 or $5 million without the permitting process. It cost hundreds of millions of dollars, but it took 17 years to get it approved and many, 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 many pages of environmental impact studies.
But are cheap infrastructure projects really worth the savings when you factor in the impacts of climate change? That's later on The Allegheny Front. Stay tuned. In advance of Hurricane Florence, airports along the Carolina coasts shut down in anticipation of flooding. A recent federal report lists dozens of major U.S. airports vulnerable to storm surges and flooding from sea level rise. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on how climate change could impact your flight and how Philadelphia's airport is adapting.
Here we go. Let's go in quick. Makes loud noises.
Climbing 120 feet above the runway in the ramp tower of Philadelphia International Airport, it's easy to see how vulnerable it is to sea level rise. Its major runway is about 260 yards from the tidal Delaware River.
Let's go back to some of the earliest maps.
Ray Scheinfeld is in charge of planning for rising sea levels at the airport. And he's showing me what was on the land before the airport was built. He's got quite a map collection.
Okay, this is from 1777. And at that time, you can see some of the drainages that went on out here, a creek called King Sessing Creek. And now we're going to look at 1898. And if you look in general, most of the area has markings on here that show that it is a marshy zone.
Like a lot of airports, Philadelphia's was built on marshy swamp and landfill. Scheinfeld says airports needed large tracts of land, convenient to cities, but far from homes and tall buildings. And that was often on the coast. And now, these airports are increasingly threatened. In 2012, Superstorm Sandy spilled more than 100 million gallons of seawater into New York City's LaGuardia Airport, shutting it down for 3 days.
If we got hit by that, there would be an event where we could have flooding of some of our taxiways or runways. We could have problems with some of our infrastructure.
Scheinfeld says if an airport shuts down, that not only leaves passengers stranded, but also prevents delivery of crucial items like medicine or emergency services. And it could cost millions of dollars in revenue for the region. Outside Terminal A East, where airplanes taxi by and baggage handlers toss luggage onto carts, Scheinfeld points to the most critical infrastructure, electric power stations.
How do you keep the lights on? How do you keep things operating?
Things like air conditioning in the terminals and baggage conveyor belts, which are located about 15 feet underground.
So now we're about to enter into the tunnels.
This is where the work begins to get luggage to passengers waiting in baggage claim upstairs. In 2013, a storm flooded this tunnel with 3 feet of water, shutting down the baggage belts and inundating an electric substation, knocking out all the power in Terminal A East. That means no air conditioning, no lights, no security. Scheinfeld explains a new method installed after that storm to keep out the water. Stackable aluminum barriers that seal the doors and protect the power.
And if we know a storm is coming or there's a potential problem, we can insert those in here and protect probably up to about 40 inches above the floor level, keeping water from getting into the substations.
Airports across the country are working to solve the same problems. Boston's Logan Airport has raised its electrical equipment and purchased new flood barriers. San Francisco's airport has runways that jut out into the bay. They've already installed concrete berms and walls and are working with the Army Corps of Engineers to do more. Rob Freudenberg has studied climate impacts on New York area airports for the Regional Plan Association. He says solutions don't come easy or cheap.
If you're talking about airports on the edge of the sea, the most likely thing you would think to do is build a higher wall around that airport. But there's a point at which you can't build a wall so high that an airplane couldn't clear it. So this is a tricky thing with airports.
Freudenberg says the problem will only get worse as the planet continues to warm and seas keep rising. A recent report by the organization predicts that in just 30 years, Teterboro Airport in North Jersey could be underwater. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
We're just learning the extent of the damage that heavy rain from Hurricane Florence caused to people's homes and businesses. Plus, have you seen the images of flooded hog farms and coal ash waste sites? And maybe you've already learned that 6 years ago, North Carolina passed legislation that prohibited state and local agencies from making planning decisions that took into account the latest climate science on sea level rise. That's in line with an executive order that President Trump issued last year. It reversed Obama's order to consider climate change in federal projects.
We're going to get infrastructure built quickly inexpensively, relatively speaking, and the permitting process will go very, very quickly.
Well, last year, the Allegheny Friends' Julie Grant spoke with Daniel Krieger about this for our Trump on Earth podcast. Krieger is executive director of the Association of Climate Change Officers, which helps businesses, industry, and professionals plan for climate change. They spoke just after Houston, the Florida Keys, and of course, Puerto Rico were devastated by hurricanes. Krieger says we design infrastructure based on the weather we've had over the last century.
Those designs can be sewers and stormwater. They can be buildings and the built environment. They could be natural systems like our farming practices.
But the weather, because of global warming, is changing.
The rules of the game are changing on us as our own fault. And now we have to figure out how are we going to play in this new world that we've created. If you look at Harvey and the 50 inches of rain, the question we should be asking is, why did 50 inches of rain turn into 10, 15, and 20 feet of flood in certain parts of Houston, particularly when there were reports from multiple agencies at different levels of government that said, we have a design problem here, and we're creating a basin when a bad enough set of rainfall comes, we're going to have a problem. 50 inches of rain did not need to translate into 20 feet of flood in neighborhoods in Houston. And yet, because we didn't have the right policy mandating either new design or an overhaul of existing design to address that issue, we had an infrastructure failure.
What did President Obama's order, the one that said climate change needed to be considered in building new infrastructure, you know, how did that kind of infiltrate and affect everything that folks that you talk with, people who are involved in the actual design, building, construction of these projects, was this sort of an opening to say, okay, now we can start really thinking about what is a real storm going to start looking like here? What do we need to be prepared for?
You think about federal agencies like FEMA or HUD, who put copious amounts of federal dollars out to either help prevent disasters or as a result of disasters. And those dollars now were starting to be doled out intelligently, either to make sure that the projects they were being doled at were accounting for climate risk in their design. Or alternatively, FEMA at one point had issued a mandate that local and state governments who are submitting their hazard mitigation plans, which they're required to do to FEMA to be eligible for FEMA funding, had to account for climate change in those plans. Then you also had the operations of the federal government. So when you're talking about military installations and national parks and monuments and other federal lands, whether it's highways and such, you were starting to see this move into planning going forward and the federal government's influence to change those behavior. And the hope was that if you could institutionalize this enough in the federal government, that you could change the practices taking place at all levels. Well, unfortunately, we didn't have enough time of that being the case. And of course, the current administration came in and is in effect really just pretty much wiping out anything that had President Obama's fingerprint on it.
President Trump said it took, in one state, 17 years to get all the permits needed to build a highway. He did not list what state that was.
This is what it takes to get something approved today. Elaine, you see that? So this is what it takes. Permitting process, flowchart. That's a flowchart. So that can go out to 20 years. This shows about 10. But that could go out to about 20 years to get something approved. This is for a highway. I've seen a highway recently in a certain state. I won't mention its name. It's 17 years. I could have built it for $4 or $5 million without the permitting process. It cost hundreds of millions of dollars, but it took 17 years to get it approved and many, 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 many pages of environmental impact studies. This is what we will bring it down to. This is less than 2 years. This is going to happen quickly. That's what I'm signing today. This will be less than 2 years for a highway.
Does he have a point there? You know, did these kinds of things really happen? And now with his order revoking President Obama's climate order on infrastructure, Trump is saying it's going to take only 2 years to get approvals for something like a highway. Can we really create or build infrastructure that's resilient if we don't have this oversight by the federal government and this requirement that climate change is considered in the building of infrastructure.
He's not wrong when he says that this is an issue that needs to be addressed. He is wrong when he oversimplifies addressing it by just saying, well, we're just going to rip it all out. Because on the flip side, if we put the money into the project and do it wrong, it's going to fail. And so there needs to be a happy medium here. We need to make sure that when we're spending dollars on infrastructure, we're spending them intelligently. We need to make sure that that process is reasonable. And then unfortunately, these systems are really complicated. The question is, how do we develop a process that intelligently addresses what those rightful intersections are while making sure that that process doesn't take decades? And climate change now is happening so dynamically and so quick, it's accelerating, that we actually are going to have to redesign how big urban centers function in particular over the next 50 years, soup to nuts. Well, it takes 50 years to build a city or to rebuild a city and re-envision it, especially if it's been overdeveloped. At some point or another, we're going to have to get our arms around how do we balance being more efficient with these processes with making sure we've done our due diligence and having intelligent design in there.
Yeah, I mean, is there some danger here if infrastructure does not consider the changes that are coming in the climate? You know, what are the concerns for loss of life, for loss of tax money in the investments that we're making into infrastructure?
Yeah, let me be clear about this, because I made these comments earlier in the context of sensible investment of dollars. The issue here is not just a dollar investment. This is a very serious issue for the public health. There are lives on the line. And you've seen it in these storms, right? Harvey, there are people who died that didn't need to die. There are people in Puerto Rico who died who didn't need to die. And there are people who've died since the storm hit who didn't need to die. The mental health impacts on people after these events is staggering. And we're just starting to see the science start to really clarify what we're dealing with. And then you're going to have issues with food security, and you're going to have issues with other forms of security. So when these systems fail, you're going to be talking about a complete change of what our civilization as a country looks like. That's going to be catastrophic to some communities more so than others, but the ripple effect is going to be massive. And the longer we go without getting smart about this, the worse it's going to get. I don't want to paint a sky is falling on this, but a lack of action is going to create a sky is falling impact on us.
Daniel Krieger is executive director of the Association of Climate Change Officers. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant by Skype last year for our Trump on Earth podcast. There's more of that conversation at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. A new episode just dropped. We're looking at President Trump versus the courts.
We have sued a lot during prior administrations, including both Republican and Democratic administrations, but this is utterly unprecedented.
That's on the new episode of the Trump on Earth podcast at TrumpOnEarth.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Oh, we're on Instagram too. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.